This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The military can't win this on the battlefield. The people of Sudan spoke over a year ago that they want a civilian-run government. So we have to keep the pressure on.
That's the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, on the conflict in Sudan. Details coming up. Also, Nigerians are worried about higher inflation after new President Bola Tinubu vowed to end petrol subsidies. And today is World No Tobacco Day. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Ceasefire talks between Sudan's warring parties have stalled after the army said it would suspend participation. For more on international efforts to bring about a lasting ceasefire in Sudan, VOA's Heidi Adams spoke with the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. Heidi first asked what influence and diplomatic tools the United States and the United Nations have available to help end the conflict.
Well, as you know, we have been actively engaged since day one in trying to find a solution. The U.S. government, working with the Saudi government, has held a number of meetings in Jeddah that got the two sides to agree to a ceasefire, to allow for humanitarian assistance. It's still a work in progress. And as the U.S. and Saudi Arabia continue to work on this, we are very supportive of those efforts here at the United Nations. We have had a number of meetings in the Security Council on the situation in Sudan. We support the African Union and IGAD efforts, these regional efforts, and we will keep putting pressure on the two sides to move toward a ceasefire that will allow for a civilian-run government. And that is something that I think has support across the board, both on the continent of Africa, but also here at the United Nations.
Ma'am, where things stand at the moment towards that that peace that you speak about, do you feel hopeful at the moment, or are you concerned about how much or how little progress is being made?
You know, I am concerned. I am concerned that the fighting continues. I'm concerned with the number of civilians who have died. Humanitarian workers have been killed. Tens of thousands of people have left Sudan because of this fighting. So I have to be concerned until the fighting ends, until the two parties come to an agreement to allow for the peaceful process that was already taking place to resume, where there will be a civilian-run government. The military can't win this on the battlefield. The people of Sudan spoke over a year ago that they want a civilian-run government. So we have to keep the pressure on. We have to increase the pressure until there is a credible ceasefire and a credible way forward.
That was U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. She was speaking with my colleague, Heidi Adams. For their full discussion, check out Straight Talk Africa on voaafrica.com. Shelling continued in Khartoum today after the Sudanese army pulled out of ceasefire talks brokered by Saudi Arabia and the United States in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. The army accused its rival, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, of failing to honor their commitments. A Sudanese government official told the French news agency AFP the army walked out because, quote, the rebels have never implemented a single one of the provisions of a short-term ceasefire, which required their withdrawal from hospitals and residential buildings. Sudanese activist Nasreen El Sayam, who escaped from Khartoum 2 weeks ago, says both sides have violated the truce, but she tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that the RSF is doing it more in plain sight.
It is very clear that both, unfortunately, are severely breaking the ceasefire. But the other part is that how much the civilians and how much the humanitarian workers are impacted in this situation. And of course, the RSF are more on the ground, more in the houses, more in the hospitals, more in the street. They are the ones who meet the normal people who are walking or trying to escape Khartoum or trying to come back to their houses to collect some of the stuff, etc., etc. So yes, from a point of view of a normal person, it is the RSF who is definitely severely violating the ceasefire.
What does it mean for the prospects of peace that the army says it has pulled out of the talks? I mean, were the talks progressing to a point where people were thinking, oh, this just might happen?
Well, people thought that the discussions and the negotiations in Saudi Arabia might actually have a good result. And everyone had huge hopes that maybe by Eid, because the other Eid we have in Islam, Al-Adha Eid, is coming very soon. It's around 30th or 29th of June. So everyone was hoping that maybe by Eid we can be home with our families celebrating the Eid as normal. But no, obviously for someone who have a bit of long vision of the situation, it was not going to happen. The conflict between the army and RSF is not on a negotiable things. The conflict between them is the conflict of a zero sum. It's either we stay or you stay. And in these kinds of conflicts, in these types, normally negotiation is just a process to gain more time and to rearrange your lines and rearrange your plans and maybe try to figure it out more. But for me personally, I was never hopeful in the negotiations happening in Saudi Arabia because I know the personality of the two leaders of the two armies, either the RSF or the Sudanese army. Both of them are very self-centric, and unfortunately, this war is also around them. Hemeti wants Al-Burhan and Burhan wants Hemeti. So there is no negotiable conditions. There is no other needs but the heads of the two armies. And of course, the commitments of the negotiations for me were not also realistic, especially in the terms of the RSF. Going out to their camps, leaving the houses. I mean, it's just like asking the RSF to go and be a sitting ducks to be hunted by the army. Of course, they will not go back to their camps because then the Air Force will just drop a few bombs on them and that's it for them.
That's Nasreen El Saim, chair of the UN Secretary General's Youth Advisory Group on Climate Change and chairperson of the Sudan Youth Organization on Climate Change. She was speaking to my colleague, Carol Van Dam from London. In Malawi, hundreds of people who were forcibly relocated to the country's only refugee camp are complaining of poor conditions with no food, clean water, or shelter. The UN's Refugee Agency and the World Food Programme say they cannot cater to the needs of those at the highly congested camp because of funding shortfalls. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, Malawi.
Malawi's government recently started to forcibly relocate about 8,000 refugees or asylum seekers who were residing in areas outside the Dzaleka refugee camp. The action followed the expiration of an April 15 deadline the government had given refugees to move to the camp. Officials say the refugees are violating a government policy that requires them to live within the boundaries of the camp. More than 1,000 refugees have so far relocated to the camp, where they have complained of dehumanizing conditions. Robert Habimana is a refugee from Rwanda. He left Dzaleka in 2008 and moved to the capital, Lilongwe, where he was running a restaurant business. Habimana told VOA on Monday that he and his family of five children have not eaten since they were transferred to the camp on Friday evening.
We have nothing. We have no food. We have no any kitchen utensil. We are just suffering. Many people left with their things.
Sabina Goma, a refugee from the Democratic Republic of Congo, says police are preventing refugees from collecting items they left behind when they were put into police vehicles during the roundup. She says we are sleeping in the open without blankets. Children are not going to school. Police are not allowing us to return to our places, even with authorization from camp officials to collect items we left. They have put roadblocks everywhere. They have just dumped us here like waste in a bin. Halina Mwaza is deputy spokesperson for the Malawi Police Service. He says the roadblocks are just some of the strategies police are using to prevent newly relocated refugees from escaping the camp.
We have reports which we're investigating that these people, some of them, they're even returning to be operating or their previous businesses, which is against the law. So they may claim that they want to get their essentials, yet they want to go back just to be operating their business. So this is why we have put up some of these sporadic roadblocks just to check on who is going out and on what purpose.
Namaza says police will soon start returning containers of property they seize from the refugees. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says Dzaleka Camp is severely overcrowded. The camp was designed to accommodate about 12,000 people, but now it is a home to over 50,000 refugees from the DRC, Burundi, Rwanda, Ethiopia, and Somalia. Many have escaped war and internal conflicts in their respective countries. The agency says further congestion could lead to outbreaks of disease. The country director for the World Food Programme in Malawi, Paul Turnbull, told VOA that the overcrowding will expose camp residents to hunger.
The relocation of refugees and asylum seekers to Dzaleka is likely to increase the numbers of people requiring food assistance at the camp. WFP is already having to distribute reduced rations due to funding shortfalls. In the current context, ensuring the continuation of assistance to refugees and asylum seekers in the camp is critical.
Some international and local rights campaigners, including the Center for Human Rights and Rehabilitation, have asked Malawi to halt the relocations, saying it is causing unnecessary suffering to the refugees and their children. The Malawian government has refused to budge, saying it gave refugees enough time to relocate to the camp voluntarily. The camp was meant to accommodate about 10,000 refugees, but now is home to more than 50,000. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta, Malawi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Despite anti-smoking campaigns that characterize the World Health Organization, No Tobacco Day today, farmers in Zimbabwe vow to continue increasing production, saying the crop is their biggest source of income. Rutendo Mawera in Harare has more.
Tobacco growers in Zimbabwe continue to turn a deaf ear to global campaigns to shun tobacco and grow other crops that are less damaging to health. Health experts warn of the health risks from growing tobacco. The Union for International Cancer Control says tobacco products kills more than 8 million people worldwide per year. The World Health Organization says one in four tobacco farmers, including women and children who help raise the crop, are poisoned by nicotine that seeps through the skin from handling the leaves of the plant. The WHO says farmers may absorb the equivalent of 50 cigarettes per day. They are also exposed to daily tobacco dust and chemical pesticides that they carry home to their families, especially children. The WHO adds that 13 million women in Africa use tobacco products, including cigarettes, chewing tobacco, and snuff. Pregnant women, who are exposed to tobacco also face a higher risk of miscarriage. But the warnings do not deter Zimbabwe's tobacco growers, who say the so-called golden leaf is fueling the economy and cannot be substituted with any other crop. Albert Chakala is a tobacco grower in Zimbabwe's Mashonaland Central Province. He explains why he will not switch to a food crop on his forester estates.
Tobacco farming is the way forward, because in tobacco you can gain a lot in a small area, but than growing maize, you need more acreage to get more.
Another grower, Trimo Churu, adds,
tobacco is a very, very important component of our economy. Because if you look, this is one of three top forex earners in the country. And it's also probably one of the biggest employers.
Foster Gwanzura, who farms the crop in Beatrice, just outside Harare, says tobacco remains one of the best options for making a living in Zimbabwe and will not support any cause to shun the crop.
We can't support the idea of banning tobacco. Because if you see each time when you start selling tobacco, the economy changes. There will be a lot of movement in the town, in the country. So tobacco should remain in production.
Gwanzura Skof said the prospects of banning of tobacco around the world.
We know they will still like smoking. So they will just talk and talk, but I think nothing will happen. We'll keep growing tobacco.
The chairperson of the Tobacco Growers Association, Bright Vukurumbwe, says some vices linked to production, such as child labor, can be fixed, but farmers will continue to grow the crop that is sustaining families. During the opening of the 2023 marketing season in March, the chairman of the Tobacco Industry Marketing Board, Patrick Devnish, said production was expected to rise 8.5% to 230 million kgs in 2023, up from 212 million kgs in 2022. Zimbabwe remains Africa's largest tobacco producer, and many farmers say they do not want that to change. For VOA, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
Nigerians are worried about higher inflation after new president Bola Tinubu vowed to end petrol subsidies. The inflation rate is already at the highest in nearly two decades, more than 22%. Tinubu made the announcement during his inauguration Monday. Nigeria spends billions of dollars annually to keep fuel affordable at the pumps, and previous administrations' efforts to stop the subsidies often led to protests. His announcement has led to long lines at gasoline stations, with economic experts saying their prices could triple within days, which could increase the prices of goods due to higher transport costs. Nigerian authorities say the country spends about $800 million monthly to keep fuel prices down, money that could be used to drive other government projects. Zimbabwe says presidential, parliamentary and local elections will be held August 23rd amid opposition allegations of violence and intimidation against government critics. Government critics say they fear a repeat of past election violence. The Government Gazette announcement also set October 2nd for a presidential runoff, if required. Zimbabwean opposition leaders say they are concerned by the date the government announced. In an interview with VOA Zimbabwe, Nelson Chamisa, the leader of the opposition Citizens Coalition for Change, said President Emmerson Mnangagwa's proclaimed a date while the nation faces several electoral irregularities.
Now that we have the date, the 23rd of August 2023, is coming to us not as a source of excitement, but as a source of concern, because we have not yet dealt with the issue of the electoral reforms.
Lloyd Damba, the spokesperson for the MDCT's presidential candidate Douglas Mwanzora, echoed Chamisa's sentiments.
The proclamation of election dates by President Emmerson Mnangagwa is a blatant disregard of the rule of law, is a blatant disregard of judicial issues, is a blatant disregard of the courts in this land. But it does not mean that the MDC is not going to be contesting this election. We are going to be contesting this election simply because we want to test the system. We want to make sure that we expose some of the things that are going to be happening in this election.
Despite the opposition's concern, Tafadzua Mugwidi, the information coordinator for the ruling ZANU-PF, said President Mnangagwa acted properly. He said the president looks forward to another term in office.
ZANU-PF is very clear. President Mnangagwa is very clear. We are going to win resoundingly in this election. This is a watershed election for the party. We are going to win in the same manner that we delivered an unmatched victory in 1980.
Mnangagwa came to power in 2017 through a military coup and in 2018's election narrowly edged his rival Nelson Chamisa with 50.8% of the vote. Under Mnangagwa's leadership, the country's economy has continued to crumble, with citizens reporting deepening poverty, chronic power cuts, and hyperinflation. Despite the challenges, analysts say the opposition parties face an uphill battle unseating Mnangagwa, given a clampdown on their campaign events and the arrests of party officials. South Africa's currency has plummeted to new lows after a U.S. official accused the country of helping Russia. The plunge in the rand is causing concern among officials, investors, and citizens as prices go up, especially for fuel, medical care, groceries, and insurance. South Africa was already facing a tough and cold winter with frequent power outages, high inflation, and other problems. The situation worsened after U.S. Ambassador Ruben Brigitte accused Pretoria of allowing a Russian ship to dock at the Simonstown Naval Base in Cape Town last December. The government denies these allegations, but the damage to the rand has been done. South Africa says it remains neutral in the war between Russia and Ukraine, but some political analysts say this really isn't the case and jeopardizes the country's participation in the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which allows duty-free access to the U.S. for South African goods. And lastly, Namibia's state broadcasters reports 13 members of the same family died after eating porridge that authorities think became toxic when it was mixed with fermented substance left over from homemade beer. The Namibian Broadcasting Corporation said 4 other people are in critical condition in a hospital. NBC, quoting the health ministry, said at least 20 people consumed the porridge. The victims ranged in age from 2 to 33. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays.